Welcome to the Managing Madrid podcast. This is your host, Gabe Lesra, and I am coming to you from a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful Washington, D.C. It's an absolutely gorgeous day, and it's made all the much better because I'm being joined by Kian Sobhany. Hey, Kian, to talk about Real Madrid's first home victory of the season, 2-0 against Espanyol.
Woo! Break out the champagne. 3 points at the Bernabeu.
Let's do it. Woo!
Finn, you saw that drawing that Finn put on Managing Madrid on the drawing board where Rick and Morty, who I don't know what the show is about, but they were searching for a universe where Real Madrid went at the Bernabeu.
Well, they found it.
They found it.
They found it. I actually also don't watch Rick and Morty, but I have friends who do. We'll break down the game, take your questions as usual. This is our free wide open show. We're going to be coming back on Wednesday with our patron only VIP show. As always, if you want to get access to that, toss us a couple bucks on Patreon, patreon.com/managingmadrid. If you toss us $5 or more per show or you're on Patreon, then you will get your question answered every single time. And we try to do our best to answer as many questions as possible. But if you do give us $5 or more, you'll get your question answered guaranteed. Okay. So, let's jump right in. Kian, that first half, I think the main talking point so far that I've seen kind of emerge out of this has been kind of the interaction between Asensio and Ronaldo, in particular that people think that Asensio is being a little bit selfish. And I wonder how much of that is true or how much of that is actually kind of a good thing, because I think that you can make the argument that selfishness is actually an important characteristic in a attacker, you know, this kind of hunger for goal. Ronaldo certainly is a selfish player, and that's good because the dude is a very good scorer and a world-class attacker.
My take on this is that Ronaldo's selfishness is different from Asensio's, because Ronaldo's selfishness is him being selfish in positions where you want him to be selfish, almost, if that makes sense. I mean, there are times where, yeah, he could probably pass and he doesn't. But given his track record, given his efficiency, he is literally the most clinical and efficient player of all time. So you want him to be selfish in certain areas, but his passing has also been really good this season. And he had his 200th assist today for the club. He had a great assist to Isco. He had some other great passes. I think the difference with Asensio is that as much as we've been hyped about him this season, and particularly this, you know, the start of the season, and particularly like when he peaked two goals against Valencia, we were just losing our minds at how good he was being. Lately, his passing, he's looked up players in deeper positions, like where, you know, against Sociedad, it was Bale who was wide open on the right flank, and if you send him, he's through on goal with his pace, and he just looked him off and he held onto the ball a bit longer. And today, I thought Ronaldo was in a better position where he could have received the ball. I don't know. Like in most cases when we get questions like this, I always tend to defend the player because I try to put myself in their shoes. We try to be objective about these things. I don't know like how real this quote unquote selfishness is. I do completely agree with everyone saying that he could have made better decisions this year with the ball. But I don't know if it's, I do imagine that at one point Ronaldo is just going to pop. Like I just feel like Ronaldo's been quote unquote such a good boy this year, where he just been so like his link up play has been great, his passing has been great, he's going to deeper positions, he's not really complaining. I just feel like at some point all of this is gonna build up and he's gonna freak out.
I mean, like the metaphor that I use and that we see a lot in other sports is that when you're this good and you're just not, it's just not kind of falling for you exactly. It's like a ketchup bottle and you're just squeezing and squeezing and then suddenly it just all sprays out everywhere. And like that's the sense I get from Ronaldo. Like he really is it's no joke. Like he's been playing really well in almost every aspect of his build-up play, and you know, obviously his assisting and passing, and he's getting him. And this is what I mentioned that you know Cristiano like has his shot more on goal than anyone else in La Liga without scoring. And my take was that it was a little unlucky, and he was forcing it occasionally. And I think that's where it is. And it's not that he's like getting worse or whatever, because he's still getting himself into the really you know tough, important positions, the kind of places that he needs to be in if he's going to continue to play. And like he's getting shots that he misses that normally he would make, and eventually those are unlucky, and those will go in. So I think the time to worry about him is if he's totally invisible, and that's not what he's been at all.
No, I agree. And just jumping to back to Asensio for a second, I think I was trying to measure this by the eye test as best as I could, and I think the statistics kind of confirmed it after the game when I went and looked at the key passes, where Asensio had 2, and Ronaldo had 5 on his own. Isco had 5 on his own. And I always had trouble kind of labeling Isco in that category. I think Isco does hold on to the ball a bit too long, but he also makes a lot of incisive passes, and so does Asensio. Yeah. We know Asensio is an amazing passer. We've seen it time and time again. We saw it against Alaves. We've seen it so many times this season when he passes. But I think his decision making could use some polishing. Like the theory behind most fans is that it's just getting to his head how good he is. I don't know if I buy that.
Yeah. This is funny. We actually had a criticism that we agree too much. So we need to figure out if we can bring on like Ohm or whatever to like disagree with us more. But yeah, my feeling is always like in this circumstance, it's actually the easier answer rather than like, oh, it's all going to his head and he's trying to be Superman, do everything. It's actually kind of a more holistic understanding that he's still a young kid who's still kind of coming up. And you know, one of the things that you work on that's hardest to kind of learn as you're coming up is your decision making. And the decision making in these crucial areas a lot of time comes down to like 1/2 a second where you have to make the decision to, you know, send the through ball or hang on and square or take your long distance shot. And, you know, as you get older and as you kind of get more experience, that's what you learn, right? You put yourself in those situations when, oh, right, last time this happened, I didn't make this pass. Now I make this pass. And the instinct is there to, you know, to make the pass rather than try to hang on to it too long or whatever. I just think that it's almost a growing pain. And it's great that he's having it because, like, it means that he's getting into these crucial positions and he's good enough to get himself there.
Well, I'd be really curious to see what Zidane's take is on this. And if I were there as press tonight, I would have tried a way to kind of get that question in and see what he says. Obviously, he'd be very political about it, but I'd be really curious to know because obviously they see what goes on in training. They see, you know, they see it on the pitch. And so, you know, one of the things that we know is that when you have players like Isco and Asensio that are so brilliant in the final third, you have to give them a leash. You can't give them a short leash because you're limiting their creativity. So you kind of have to live and die with their decisions.
Right.
And you have to allow them to play in the final third and kind of anything goes at that point. Like you have a general idea of how you want to build up, but you have to leave room for them to make decisions. And if they hold on to the ball a bit longer, you have to give them the benefit of the doubt is because they see something that no one else sees. And that's that's the kind of live and die approach that you have to take with these players. But I don't know. I definitely think that he does need to sharpen his decision making, you know, and that is something, whether it's intentional or not, whether he has a big head or not, he does need to polish that part of his game, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's regardless of why, you know, and I was trying to be a little bit, you know, in my interpretation is less like, with the big head getting to him and more of the other stuff. But regardless, it's still something that he needs to work on regardless of why. So if it's because he's getting a big head, someone needs to knock him down a couple of pegs. And if it's just because he's a young kid working on his game, someone needs to take him, you know, under his wing and maybe Ronaldo chewing him out about that ball, because we know Bale isn't the type to go up to him and chew him out for not giving him the ball there. But I think Cristiano Ronaldo in a situation where if you put him through, he'd score is not going to let Asensio forget that that was an option. And that's actually an important thing to learn as a young player, right? Like that, you know, you need to understand where everyone else is in the pitch, and someone like Ronaldo is going to remind you that, hey man, like, give me the ball. I was open. This is a time for me to shoot. And it's also better for the team. Like, it's not just Ronaldo being right, like, egoistic or whatever. It's better for the team if Ronaldo scores there, because then they score. Let's see other stuff going forward. I wanted to chat a little bit about Isco, who had, I thought, you know, absolutely fantastic game today.
I think you can give him the case for man of the match, obviously. You know, something interesting that Zidane said after the game was that Isco and Ronaldo swapped roles today, where Isco was essentially Ronaldo and vice versa. I don't know what he meant by that. I don't know if he meant that it was pre-designed or if that's just kind of how it unfolded, with Ronaldo dropping a bit deeper and he was playing the assists and Isco was finishing. But either way, what I did like about this whole thing was that, you know, often we tend to talk about Ronaldo's strengths, which, as we should. He's very good in any time, anywhere he has the ball on the pitch. Like, if he drops deep to retain possession or to provide an outlet, I'm always confident that he'll hold on to possession for us. He'll be able to kind of recycle possession and play the right pass and not lose the ball. And I think he's, you know, we don't really talk about that because obviously that's not something that he's made a living off of. That's not what he's known for historically. And he's obviously so incredible at other things that we don't really talk about that. And I think today was a nice opportunity to kind of just remind everybody that, you know, he is this narrative that he's so selfish, and he's good with, you know, when he's not scoring, he does other things. And, you know, so whether it's sucking defenders in or playing a great pass or beating someone on the flank and getting a cross, and he did a lot. And I think it was cool to kind of see him in a deeper role and providing those passes to Isco, who did brilliant job at finishing.
Yeah, and that's something that I wanted to bring up, because you just to piggyback off of that point, you get the sense that Ronaldo is such a good player that, you know, what Madrid has done is magnify his best characteristic, right, which is as a, you know, winger slash striker who's just an incredible finisher and goal creator. But you also get the sense that if you played Ronaldo, right, at, like, center mid, he would still be really good, right? And even at, you know, center back, like, he is not a player that's going to, you know, get into a position where he's going to lose the ball in a really tough location or misplace a pass or something. He's actually really good at this sport, just kind of generally, and good enough to play at, like, center mid or center back for a lot of other teams at this level. And just that he happens to be arguably the best ever at creating goals in the final third. And so that's where Madrid plays him. But you could definitely see Ronaldo flourishing as a center mid also.
Well, I mean, not that Real Madrid would ever play him there, but it's kind of like the story of Real Madrid in a nutshell. Like, their whole team is like this, right? Luka Modric, you know, we were questioning the idea of putting him on the right flank last season when Zidane shifted to the diamond with Isco up top, just in behind the striker. And Modric played the right wing role, like, better than any traditional right winger I've seen in the past year. It was amazing. Like, he was a two-way presence on the flank. He was beating players. He was crossing the ball in. He was defending. And, you know, Ceballos is versatile. Like, Isco and Asensio can play multiple positions, Bale. And so I think we're spoiled in that sense that, it's, you know, this is what Ronaldo can do. And we don't really talk about it, but the whole team is just so versatile.
Yeah, and I think it's just a testament to the way the roster has been constructed that I think there's been a premium put on this versatility. Speaking of versatile, can we just spare a second to talk about Nacho, who was absolutely imperial in this match, not just as the left, you know, the strong defensive presence, which he did, and once again had a goal-saving tackle, but also shockingly showing up constantly in the attack, just like Marcelo was always asked to do, receiving the ball deep, making, you know, incisive runs, stealing the ball even from people way up the pitch. Like, he was really, really, really good on that left wing, I thought.
Yeah, that's Nacho. He's been like that all season. I mean, he was like that against Dortmund. He was like that against Alaves.
It's just such an underrated asset to have someone who can literally put at any position on the back line. Like, he could play right back too, if you know, and he has.
He's like the Guti of the back line of this era, but more consistent. He just, like, whenever you need him, he's there, and he can play in so many positions, and he's reliable.
Totally.
I just, yeah, I'm going to, you know, he's still far from having a finished career, but he's one of those players, like, we don't talk about enough, and we probably won't talk about, but, like, once he retires, you're going to miss him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Or, you know, moves on if he decides to. But the cool thing about him is that he seems to want to stick around, which is good.
He likes his role. I mean, you just tip your hat off to him. Like, he's an amazing character to have.
So let's talk a little bit. And before we jump into questions, I wanted to talk a little bit about Madrid's slowdown at the beginning of the second half, which from minute 45 through minute 70, when they scored the second goal, I thought that Espanyol really was comfortably in, you know, in the driver's seat, and it was not something that was particularly fun to watch. Have you thought about, like, what exactly was going on? You think it was just a intensity slowdown? Do you think it was, you know, just you know, kind of a players getting tired? Or, I mean, I was trying to figure it out, because, like, the first half, Madrid spent almost the whole half in Espanyol territory, just hammering the ball in. And in the second half, you know, Espanyol came out with a number of important good chances, and Madrid's defense just, you know, started to look really bad, you know, with Espanyol getting balls behind Ramos and Varan, including a time when, you know, the man appeared to be one-on-one with Kehler, and then Varan, you know, used his speed to overtake him. But I'm interested in your take on that particular period of time.
Well, my take is on this is that so Espanyol started the first half and essentially played the entire first half with every single player behind the ball. And there were moments I actually noted in the first half where they actually had 9 to 10 players in their own box. And that's fine. I mean, I think Quique Sánchez-Flores probably just looked at Quique Setién's playbook from the Bernabeu earlier this season and was like, well, that worked. So, you know, let's try it. And right. I think he probably took it an even more extreme level. But what I thought, I knew eventually they would have to open up in the second half, being down a goal. And I thought it would come closer to, like, the 75th minute mark. I didn't think it would come, like, right out at the second half. I think that's essentially what happened, was they kind of just, they uncuffed themselves from these defensive, you know, duties. And they started to press high a little bit, and they started to put pressure on Real Madrid's high defensive line. And especially when Nacho and Achraf were caught up the field, they were able to go get these through balls, which Varane had to just close off last second, or Nacho coming in to save Ramos's blushes with that giveaway in the second half. And I think Real Madrid probably didn't expect Espanyol to do that right away. Like, I think they finished the first half being accustomed to what Espanyol were doing. They probably started the second half with the game plan, thinking that Espanyol were just going to bunker up. And Espanyol, they just went forward. And you know, the interesting thing was they didn't even really sacrifice their defensive shape until a bit later, like, and you saw with the second goal with when Real Madrid had numbers on the counter and they essentially just finished Espanyol off. But I think that was the biggest thing, is that Quique really changed things at halftime in terms of his philosophy. He pressed high. He ventured forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I thought they within reason, they kept their defensive shape, and Real Madrid just were caught off guard with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right? The Setién playbook, it did work, right, for Betis. But I would, if I were...
Required some luck, too.
It really did, though, right? Like, Madrid took so many shots. Like, they hit the post twice. Like, the playbook... You know, I think you'd be happy. You have to be a little bit crazy to think that that was going to work every game for you, or even, like, give you a real shot, because, like, Madrid had scored in 73 games going into that match, and the only reason they didn't score is because of all the different things that had to go wrong. So, yeah, that was the kind of game where, if you're analyzing that as a coach looking for ways to attack Madrid, there were ways that were flaws in that match, but the idea that you would bunker in against a side that can create this kind of, like, the number of goals that this that Madrid would normally just kind of fall into is a little silly, I thought. And it was nice to see, you know, look, obviously I didn't enjoy it. It was nerve-wracking, but it was good to see Quique come out with that kind of positive attitude in the second half and release, because this Espanyol team is not bad.
No, it's not. And they kind of made a surge towards the second half of last season and maybe regressed a little bit this season, but I think they're good enough. I would say that something that interesting that Zidane said after the game, and he's usually not this candid about terms of his answers are usually very political. I felt he was a bit more candid than usual today. And someone had asked him about why do Real Madrid struggle at home? And he essentially said, look, we can go to Dortmund. And who was the other one? I think he said Sociedad, who are essentially better teams than Espanyol. But when you play away from home, you're also playing against teams who are not in their shell.
Right.
So when teams come to the Bernabeu, especially teams with less talent, they're going to bunker up. And I think that is part of the reason we struggle. And he mentioned that.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. And I kind of, it was interesting to hear it from him. I mean, this is the thing. Like, this is kind of part of the reason why we do struggle at home. It's for this reason. I think if I were a team against Real Madrid at home, even a bigger team, I'd consider playing the same way, to be honest. But
Yeah.
yeah.
So I think the next topic that I wanted to get into is actually a topic that some of our patrons asked about. So let's just go right into the questions, unless we have any other things that you wanted to mention, Keon, before we jump into these questions.
No, I think they'll probably get covered in the questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the topic that I was going to jump to next, and I see that we have two questions about it, is Ashraf Hakimi, who made his first team La Liga starting debut, the youngster. Let's just read the question so we can chat about it. Guled Ismail asked us, "What do you guys think of Ashraf today?" And Joao dos Santos asked us, "What did you guys make of Hakimi's debut? And what chances do you think he has to become a regular starter at some point during the next 5 seasons or so?" What do we think about Ashraf? My feeling was there was a lot to like about this debut, actually. And there were some, obvious, mind farts and times where he got burned. But overall, I was much more willing to take the optimistic viewpoint, projecting him forward than the negative.
Yeah. No, I agree. In the first half in particular, my Twitter feed was like having an orgasm over him, and I didn't think he was like otherworldly good, and maybe I was a bit more cautious with it. He got burned once at least in the first half that led to a chance for Espanyol. And he had a couple misplaced crosses, but he also recovered from that play by tracking back and regaining possessions, and he had a couple of really good crosses too. And I thought overall, for a player who's making his home debut or La Liga debut at the Bernabeu, I thought he did really well.
Yeah, and
I really, I really, yeah, I really don't want to complain about him. I thought he was good.
he had a very real positive contribution to both Madrid's attack and defense, despite kind of some of the lapses. Like there were a couple times where he just kind of dribbled into someone and lost the ball. A couple times where he got burned, but overall, like this wasn't just a negative thing. This was actually quite a solid first debut. It's hard for, I mean, the dude is what, 18? So like it's this is one of the youngest players on the squad, and this is his first time there, and there's a lot to like in his profile. He profiles very speedy, offensively, and capable and defensively solid right back. I was very impressed that in minute 89, right, there was a counterattack. Madrid are up 2-0, and Espanyol to counter, maybe get a goal back, and absolutely the only person, that could do anything it was Ashraf, and he just kind of blazed out of nowhere to steal the ball. Very impressive. I thought very impressive generally getting back and making up for his mistakes. Like that's a big and important part of playing in the on the wings in the back. You have to be speedy and you have to know exactly when to get the hell back. And he definitely has that instinct. So I was pleased by that.
Yeah, his pace is amazing, and this is something I mentioned last season too, is that watching with Castilla, it was interesting because any time that he was caught out of position, he could catch up to a player that had caught him out with the ball and just sprint back and retain possession. He's that quick. Like, you can have a head start on him and it doesn't matter. And he'll get back and he'll, you know, then that's such a massive asset as a wing back.
Yeah, absolutely. So becoming a regular starter in the next five seasons or so. No, I don't think so. Donny Carvajal is young enough that without any injuries, and obviously that's, you know, the knock on wood thing, without any major injuries to Carvajal, I don't see Ashraf taking over for him in the next five seasons, though. I also could see him going out on loan. I could also see him sticking around at Madrid as the backup right back heir apparent, because Carvajal is, 4 or 5 years older than him, mm-hmm. Just like Baran was for Pepe. I don't know. I don't think, though, in the next 5 years, absent some injury to Carvajal, he'll take over.
Yeah, I mean, Carvajal's only 25, and sometimes that's crazy enough to even just think about how long he's been around. He's only 25. He's 7 years older than Ashraf. I mean, it's a good question. Like, these questions are so hard to answer because it's almost impossible to predict what happens a year from now. And 5 years is like a whole other era in my views. But Carvajal is definitely, assuming that he continues to play at a high level, he's still the starter. I don't know what Ashraf turns into and what his role in the team turns into. You might be right. Maybe it might be alone. Maybe it might just be a guy who rotates heavily into the squad, like a Nacho or something, and gives Carvajal rest. I don't know, but
yeah, I mean, just remember, like, I think that the best case scenario is looking something, you know, assuming it, you know, the kind of general pace of improvement, like something like Varane, right, where you came in, yeah, as a kind of sensational teenager, and he kind of importantly rotates in the squad, and someone you can really trust, and then understands that when it's time for the guy to move on, he's the guy who's ready. And, you know, he's 18, so in 5 years, Carvajal will be 30, and he'll be 23, and that's exactly when Varane basically took over for Pepe. So yeah. It's not a bad model. But that being said, Kian, I totally agree. One of the things that people really do, and it's kind of dumb, is really try to project so far in the future with these lineups. And, like, someone's like, oh, well, in, you know, 2022, Real Madrid's lineup will be like Odegaard and Vinicius and Asensio and all this shit. And, like, you have no idea. Like, we don't have any idea what's going to happen. Like, Barcelona might not even be in the Spanish league in 2022.
I mean, here's the thing. Even the manager doesn't know this answer to this question.
I mean, we barely know what the lineup next year is going to look like. So, like, yeah, you know, next month, like, fuck, it's hard, but yeah, like the best thing you can do to prepare for the future is to have young, good players. And that's what Madrid is built in this lineup right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Blake Brown. So I want to apologize. Last podcast, I don't know which podcast, but one of the ones recently, I mentioned that it was probably Blake. I thought it was Blake's first question. It was not. Blake has been a patron for at least for about a year. So I'm sorry, dude. That was big time. My bad. So Blake says, another win. Really good to see it at home. The season, this season, there's been, has there been two more important players in Isco and Bale? Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to argue with that. Actually, I mean, Bale has obviously been really on fire this season, and Isco has been crucial. So
yeah, I mean, it kind of varies from game to game. Bale has been huge, Isco's been huge, Asensio earlier in the season was massive and, like, huge against Valencia. A player like Luka Modric,
right? Like, that's
like, he, you know what's funny is that with Modric, like, we always have a man of the match, and Luka Modric is always, like, either second or, like, probably in contention for man of the match himself. Like, he's always a man of the match alongside the man of the match, because he's just so consistently good for us. And I think Modric is a huge case. Kroos, I think, has been really great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Isco and Bale have been huge offensively, especially in the time of, you know, Ronaldo wasn't around in La Liga for 5 games. Benzema's been injured, so we need someone to pick up the scoring slack. And between Isco, Bale, and Asensio, I think those three, if they can combine, like, for, like, I don't know, 35 goals among the three of them, that would be, I think, we'd be pretty happy with that, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So moving on, Jimmy Obaid asks us, first one, he wants to note, thank you to all of you who have chipped into our page. This is not Jimmy, just me saying, like, thank you all. Jimmy, you especially, thank you for your donations. This is awesome. We really appreciate it, and it helps us. You know, obviously, I think that the podcast sounds better now than it did even a few months ago because we've upgraded mics and software. Mm-hmm. So that's going on. So yeah. So Jimmy asks, when all the BBC is healthy, Jesus returns riding a Harley. Who will Zidane start in the big games? Isco, Benzema, or Bale? Or will the starting spots be rationed out? Yeah, I mean that's the billion-dollar question. In a hypothetical Champions League final with everyone healthy, it's hard to imagine sitting Isco. Mm-hmm. But you know, obviously people haven't been healthy together yet. I think that the thing to remember is that there's always going to be a next game, and so there will be rationing and rotating even in what we would call big games. So like, it's possible, like, you know, against Atletico, like, you know, everyone will be healthy, but he'll start Bale, Ronaldo, Isco, or, you know, Asensio, Ronaldo, Isco, or Asensio, Ronaldo, Bale, or Asensio, Benzema, like any combination of those players up front, or I'll do a 4-4-2, dropping Bale back with Ronaldo and Benzema or something. But I think that, you know, my take, Keon, is that going forward, like, we're still going to see rotations, even what we would call big games, just because I think Zidane is still drilling into his players' heads that this isn't a case where a rotated lineup isn't the best lineup. Like, each one of these players feels very important on the side. So I don't know. Maybe that's a cop-out.
No, you know, it's not, because, you know, it's funny. We always say, by we, I don't know, some fans, they always say, well, Isco should leave because he's not a starter, he's not appreciated. I mean, and he's played almost every game, he started every game just by default. And this has been like a recurring thing for like a year now, at least, where it's just everyone being healthy is almost like mythical now at this point. Like Jimmy said, like, when Jesus returns riding Harley, like, it's very possible last time BBC was healthy and everybody was healthy, it was the same time Jesus was still on the earth. I don't know. It seems, and I almost forget. Like, but here's the thing, like, rotations will be a thing, you know, throughout the season. So in a way, it doesn't matter who starts. The only time rotations won't be a thing is in a do or die game. So in a Champions League knockout stage, in the final, like, you know, the must win games in La Liga. And then if everybody is healthy in that scenario, who is it that gets dropped? And in my opinion, it should be Benzema. Because
I agree.
You know, we kind of saw a glimpse of it in Dortmund with Isco, Bale, and Ronaldo together. And I thought, and I think, and we saw it, you know, we've seen it a couple times last season too, and I think that is the best way to go.
So I just wanted to also shout out Leo Wiles Shadid asked us about Ashraf and whether he starts against Tottenham. I think there's a long time before a match against Tottenham, my man, so I don't think Donny Carvajal will be out then. So I don't know. Is there some new thing, Keon, that we know that Carvajal will be out?
We just,
like, in mid-October?
Well, he has been diagnosed for maybe about a month, so I don't know.
Okay, so he may be still out, he may be back. Anyways, I think if, assuming that, so let's just for purposes of discussion, assuming he's out, I think, yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I think it's probably Nacho on that side and Marcelo on the other side.
Or Teo. I'm not sure when Marcelo. I can't remember off the top of my head when.
I'm pretty sure Marcelo is coming back more sooner than Carvajal.
Okay. Yeah, in that case, it's for sure going to be Nacho at right back.
Because, you know, Tottenham's a real tough team. So I find it hard to imagine starting a kid against Harry Kane and Dele Alli and Eriksen. All right, Nate McDougall, I'm really glad you sent this, my man, because I did not understand. But last week you sent us a question about the definition or about the 5-4-3-2-1 rule, and we just now you've explained it, and that makes sense. It's a list of Ronaldo's trophies, 5 Ballon d'Or, he will win it this year, 4 Champions League, 3 Premier Leagues, 2 La Ligas, and 1 Euro Cup. So just wondering if you guys knew of any player who could compete with that trophy count. I mean, obviously Messi is the one that comes to mind, but the thing is that Messi hasn't won anything with his national team. So, you know, it's the one at the end there that really stands out in terms of Messi's trophy cabinet. And yeah, I mean, like, that's tough.
Yeah, I mean, and going back to Nate's question last week, I think this was on the Patreon only podcast. So I think he asked, besides Messi, is there anyone that can basically rival this? And I can't think of the closest person after Messi to be close to Ronaldo's 5 Ballon d'Ors would be Cruyff, and I think Platini had 3 each. And so it almost has to be someone who hasn't gotten there yet. So someone like Neymar or someone Mbappe in the future, I don't know. But then they also need to be prolific. They need to get a lot of trophies. They need to win internationally. So I don't know. Football proves us wrong all the time, but I'm not sure if it happens anytime soon. I don't
Ronaldo
know.
Has moved between leagues, which Messi never did. So Messi has not had the opportunity to win 3 Premier Leagues, but he's also won quite a few more Ligas, right? I don't know. This is a tough question. I think it's important to remember that we're in an era of these kind of absolute super player gods, with Ronaldo and Messi are rewriting record book after record book of a sport that's been around for 100 years plus. Like, these guys are really that good. Like, this is, you know, the Pelé, George Best, Maradona level, Di Stefano. Like, this is the level of players these guys are. Like, we're lucky that we get to experience them, and we're incredibly lucky we have Ronaldo on our team. And it's, you know, despite how much I despise him, and despite the fact that he is literally carrying Barcelona by himself right now, given how bad Suarez is, it's great. It's incredible that we get to watch Messi also. Like, and I know that Barcelona fans wouldn't give us the same respect regarding Ronaldo, or a lot of them wouldn't, but I think that it's really lucky that we're watching both of these guys at the same time. Yeah. Okay. Giorgi Sinsadze, J. I think that's a DZE. It's hard to pronounce that last one. What books? Oh, this is an awesome question. What books would you recommend about the history of Real Madrid and or Spanish football that are available in English? All right. So just off the top of my head, Keon is writing a book right now that I think you should buy when it comes out.
Obviously. Hobbs. It won't necessarily be about Real Madrid's history, but it's going to be about Florentino and some of the more modern history about the club.
In addition to Keon's book, I would recommend Sid Lowe's book. I mean, that's really the kind of gold standard. It's called Fear and Loathing in La Liga, and it's a history of Spanish soccer, kind of generally from Franco up through now. I really think that, like I said, I think that's the gold standard. And then there are all these other books written by kind of journalists about individual teams. Like, I know that, you know, enemy of mine, Graham Hunter, has a couple of books about Barcelona and how they're the best team ever. I'd make jokes about that. He's not an enemy of mine. I just made one comment about him once that he took it angrily. But, there are plenty of other books. So I would just Google around, like, maybe you'll see, with respect to your favorite journalist, see if they've written books. Like, obviously, Keon and Sid are, you know, are going to, Keon will and Sid has done the great book. So,
you for sure also have to check out Stephen Mandis's book, The Real Madrid
Way. Yeah.
Which is not necessarily about the history.
That's so rude.
Well, it's not necessarily about the history of La Liga or history about Real Madrid, but it gives you an amazing insight about kind of just the machinery and the brand and what Florentino has achieved and the values of the club, all of that. And that is a must read, The Real Madrid Way.
Yeah, sorry, and sorry, Stephen, if you're listening to this. That's my bad. I obviously get Stephen's book. It's really good. I was one of the, you know, I read it over, helped you know, toss in some thoughts, and I think it's a really well done piece about you know, all the different things that go into why, you know, making Real Madrid the club that it has been. And one of the cool things about the book is that it was written during and, you know, the La Décima season, about how Madrid's culture of winning is such an important part of the club. And it's interesting because it's actually kind of prophetic about how the club would move on from, you know, a period where, yeah, they'd been close to the peak, but then has really become this kind of global dominant superpower in Europe and in Spain. You know, and really kind of isolating and pointing to the parts of the culture and the history of the club that they created that culture that that Madrid has called upon time after time, you know, when going through tough situations in this run of form that you know, in this run of trophies that hadn't actually happened when the book was being written. So I thought that's, you know, it presaged this incredible run from Real Madrid. So that's very cool too. Mm. All right. So we have time to do a couple, you know, maybe one or two questions from people that don't have guaranteed questions. I wanted to jump right to this one. Elian Zacco, he repeats his question. He is on a crusade against Kaylor. And I just want to say, ma'am, we have answered this question before, but let's just really quickly. Do you really think that Keylor Navas is world class, let alone Real Madrid level? And then he points out he makes fundamental goalkeeper mistakes in every match. He also never catches easy shots. He does. He make matters worse because those shots don't have that much power on them. He fails to parry them far from his own goal. You're saying, all in all, I think Keylor Navas is a good keeper, but not good enough for Real Madrid. I don't agree at all with this. So that's fine. We can disagree, my man. But that's, I mean, I would just say, look at the scoreboard. Like, this team has done and accomplished amazing things with Keylor in goal, and he has continually risen to that level of, you know, grabbing incredibly important stops. And it's interesting that you would send this question to us after a game where Keylor was huge for Madrid and came up big time after time, including a couple of times when it was really just one-on-one that he stopped. So yeah. It's interesting to hear this question after this match.
I don't really have anything to add. I feel like this is almost like a copy and paste of Elian's question a few podcasts ago where he said these exact same things. I may have been right after the Betis game, actually. Well, I'm also confused that he says this rating of Keylor is not only based on his mistakes, like the own goal versus Betis. Did he score an own goal versus Betis that I'm missing?
No. That wasn't an own goal against Betis. I don't know what this is about. This is maybe with Valencia. I don't know. There was the game against Sociedad where I think he let in a relatively easy shot, right? I don't know what you're talking about, man. Maybe.
Well, at any rate, he was brilliant today. In a way, yep. I can kind of see, like, yeah, he's made mistakes in the past season or two after his brilliant performance 2 seasons ago. Yeah, maybe he's not Oblak. Maybe he's not Neuer. Maybe he's not
Courtois. Maybe. I mean, like, but you know what? He is fucking fantastic. So, you know, chill. He's going to be fine. And eventually Madrid is going to move on from Keylor, and it may very well be next summer. In fact, that was my prediction. But right now, he's still a very high-class keeper. I mean, I watched him single-handedly defeat teams in the World Cup, and then recently with Costa Rica, where they rely on him way more than Madrid does, and he stands for his country incredibly well. So you should... You know, I would encourage you to watch some matches that he plays for Costa Rica where the shots are constantly coming because they're not a good team except for him.
I think he'll be fondly remembered when his time is done because he was a part, obviously, the goalkeeper of one of the best Real Madrid teams of all time. And, you know, if you go back in Real Madrid's history, it's not like they had a crazy amount of great keepers. I mean, before Casillas, you know, we had Ilgner, and then you need to go back to like some Zamora and some other guys, and
he's a legend.
And I imagine that they will move on from, like you said, eventually, and maybe it's De Gea, maybe it's Kepa, I don't know, but you know, great goalkeepers are also kind of rare and they don't grow on trees. And if you're not Keylor, who are you going to bring in at this point? It's not always clear cut to just write a check to whichever goalkeeper you want. And the other thing was, last season, it is a known fact that Zidane and Ronaldo and some of the other guys actually went to Florentino and said, we want to keep Keylor. We like him.
He's an incredible clubhouse guy. Yeah. And he's, You know, there's actually a Keylor Navas movie coming out soon.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And it look, it's going to suck, but he is awesome. So
is it going to suck? Why is it going to suck? I haven't seen anything of it.
Dude, have you ever seen a movie about a soccer player? They're terrible. Like Cristiano Ronaldo has a movie.
I've never even seen the Ronaldo one.
They're bad. They're just bad. But that's okay.
I've seen the Pelé one on Netflix, which is okay.
It's okay? Really? That's better than normal for these movies. I mean, look, it's whatever. He's awesome. And that's the crucial thing to remember also is that he's a clubhouse guy. And that's, you know, that's awesome. Everyone loves him. And that's part of being a good goalie, right? Good keeper is to be a unifying presence that, you know, no one is going to be, you know, pissed. And one of the things that in Casillas's last couple of years, he really wasn't, right? And that's why when Kaylor came in, there was this level of stability in the dressing room that hadn't been there when Casillas was the only keeper. Mm. I don't want to reopen this wound. I'm not trying to rag on Casillas. I'm just saying that, like, don't overlook his clubhouse, his dressing room, you know, positives that he brings there, because that's not a guarantee. Like, I'm not, you know, I haven't heard any negative things about De Gea, particularly in the dressing room, but he has baggage outside of the club that is not ideal. Okay, so I think that's it for us for this week. Toss us a couple bucks on Patreon. You'll be able to hear our midweek show, which is patron only. $5 or more, you'll get your question answered. If you decide to toss us more than that, we have escalating rewards up until if you toss us like $100, I think we said you can come on the show. Keon, I think that's one of them. Yeah, so for example,
it's true.
We also have a couple others, like if you 25 or 50, we'll write an article for you on your subject of your choice. So that kind of stuff.
We should do patron shoutouts.
Yeah. So patron shoutouts.
So one of the rewards is actually if you pledge $10 or more, you get a specific shout out on the podcast. And this list is growing. We actually have a couple new ones just for this episode. So shout out to every single one of our 161 patrons, which is bonkers. Sorry, 172. It just keeps growing. Can't even keep track.
It was only 160 some last time I checked 20 minutes ago.
172. It's incredible. And so shout out to all of you. Shout out to these ones specifically because you pledged $10 or more. Bob Rahal. Oh my God, I got to scroll through. Okay, Nick DeStefani. Frederick Sundros, Doug Chisholm, Leon Stavranakis, Edna Rose Fuertes, Bjorn Salvador, Jahan Watson, John Fernandez, Said Mahad, Bavik Shah, Sergio Monleon, Red Bat, Anthony Vasquez, Yahya Ibrahim, Kenny Gultzler, Gulid Ishmael, Nick Ribeiro, Eric Rogers, Steven Mandis, Andrew Gomez, Anton Hackberg, Jimmy Obeid, Daniel Smith.
You guys are the best.
That was crazy.
This is getting longer.
Like, almost blacked out.
It's so cool. Oh my God. So yeah, thank you all so much. And we'll be back with our Patreon only show on Wednesday.
I guess we'll have some international break stuff, which is no one really wants to even.
Unfortunately, it's international break week, so that I just remember that bums me out a little bit.
Us some cool questions. Give us some like questions about history or some things that distract us from the international break. Zidane himself was not thrilled about after the game. And, like, he was saying, you know what? None of my players are going to get an international break rest, including Gareth Bale, whom they don't even want to send. Let's just pray to the gods that.
Yeah, that's the only thing that matters in international breaks, that none of our players get injured. That's literally it. So just hope, because, like, God, it would suck. We'll be back. You can ask us whatever also. Like, you can ask any of the junk that you feel like. We take other questions other than just about Real Madrid, especially because it's international break. All right. We'll talk to you on Wednesday then. And Ala Madrid.
Ala Madrid.